She is, in my observation and experience, one of the smartest people in broadcast journalism today. I've been interviewed by her a number of times and know that I've got to work a little harder to prepare to be questioned by someone who is not going to simply accept whatever I say. Born in New Jersey, a Jersey girl, if I may, Stephanie Ruhle started her career in business and finance, where she became a success after just 14 years at Merrill Lynch, Credit Suisse, and Deutsche Bank. Indeed, at one point, Stephanie Ruhle was the highest producing credit derivative salesperson in the United States. In 2011, Stephanie left finance and joined Bloomberg Television, where she co-hosted and hosted several shows there, including one with my friend David Weston. In 2017, Stephanie moved to MSNBC, co-hosted and hosted shows there. I got to know her as a guest and regular viewer of her 9 a.m. show. Stephanie began every show with the words, "Let's get smarter." Today, Stephanie Ruhle is the host of MSNBC's 11th Hour, which airs at 11 p.m. Eastern Time every weekday. In addition to all that, Stephanie Ruhle is one of the funniest dinner party hosts you will ever meet, with a wicked smart sense of humor. Stephanie, welcome, and let's get smarter.
I'm just going to disappoint people. Now, with an intro like that, I can only go down from here.
Well, let me start with a couple of questions about business and the economy. We just, several days ago, concluded a deal between our president and Congress to raise the national debt for the next 2 years, linked to cuts in federal government spending. Do you think it's a good idea to link congressional action on the debt ceiling with spending cuts or spending increases?
Well, listen, Republicans don't have a lot of leverage, and so they got to use it where they can. We needed to get the debt ceiling raised because that's how our government operates. It's how we function. And so they were going to use this to get some cuts where they wanted them cut, because President Biden was able to pass a number of things that they weren't necessarily keen on, though, of course, they were in agreement as we passed the budget. So I think, you know, it's a little bit like how what the president said. Neither side got everything they wanted, but everyone got what they needed. And I actually think, while people are frustrated, when things get done on a bipartisan way, that's good. We want those checks and balances. I think the line that serves the lion's share of the country. I hate the way it went down. I hate the dance. I hate what it cost this country. I hated the drama of all of that, just utter stupidity. But I am thrilled that the debt ceiling was raised. And it's unthinkable to me that there were any lawmakers, whether they were serious or just toying with it, with this idea that we should default. I mean, it would just be catastrophic for us and the world economy. And so I'm glad at the end, and you saw, right, the president was muted in, and he was thankful to the Republicans who worked on it and the Democrats who worked on it, you know. And while we have all thought, when it took Kevin McCarthy 15 tries to get the votes to be speaker, we thought he is really going to be beholden to the far right wing of the party. And in the end, with the debt ceiling, it was kind of like old school politics, old school politicians showing up and negotiating. And that's a good thing.
What would the default on our national debt have meant for the average American?
Everything would cost more, right? So remember, we are the cleanest dirty shirt. We're the best lender out there, right? People look at the United States with the highest credit rating. And if suddenly we're looked at as a deadbeat, people aren't going to want to do business with us. And everything in our lives that we need to borrow for would cost more. And it would cost businesses more money to operate. And when they have to spend more money to operate, they then start laying people off. It would have terrible impact on right. our economy. And I'm thrilled that we averted it. But it's hardly like this was a huge government win. We should do it.
The national debt, the growing national debt, is something that for too many Americans is sort of an abstract concept.
Totally.
It's always the bottom of the inbox for our national leaders. How concerned are you about our growing national debt? Some people regard it even as a national security threat. How do you think of it?
Listen, it's a very big problem, but it's a complicated one. And unfortunately, it's not one that resonates with voters, right? You said it. It's very abstract. If I said national debt was a gazillion or a quadrillion, people wouldn't necessarily know. They know it's too much, but they also know that programs that they rely on, they don't want to get cut. So our national debt is a problem, but there are other things that I see as bigger problems, and I don't want us to take them away. So it's not one that's an easy solve, that's for sure.
I've heard you talk about our tax code and ways in which it is unfair, favors the rich, so forth. What's your overall sense of the tax code? Is our tax code fair? It's kind of a leading question, I know, but
it's not. It's not. I mean, like, listen, as long as there are tax departments at companies, right? As long as there are tax lawyers, as long as there are sophisticated tax preparers, that means there are loopholes to seek and there are ways to get around paying big dollars, right?
And guess what? People who can afford good tax preparers are the rich. So they,
if you can afford a good, our tax code is so complicated that if you can afford very highly compensated tax preparers, you will pay less in taxes. That's just the way our system works. And it is filled with loopholes. And while, you know, we have all sorts of incentives, and even if they start with all the best of intentions, they quickly get twisted and morphed into something else. And it's our lowest or middle income people that just bear the brunt. It's crazy to me that the Republicans have been dead set on, you know, quote unquote, defunding the IRS, right? The IRS has a hugely difficult job to do. And right, and we all complain when it takes a while for our returns to come back or nobody answers the phone. They're operating on a computer system from decades ago, right? Right. And so doing your taxes is complicated enough. We need to have well-compensated people working at the IRS, because the people who most often cheat are people who understand the complicated tax system, and we should be going after them, right? The amount of money we're saying we should put into the IRS is a fraction of the money we would get back from the amount of people and businesses that are scamming the system.
Of course, Stephanie, I hate to tell you this, but much of our federal government operates on a computer system that is decades old. You can't even find the spare parts anymore.
But isn't that crazy? Like, that's a perfect example of when you talk about American exceptionalism, American entrepreneurship is part of that, right? We here on American soil, we have some of the most sophisticated technology companies out there, and how our technology giants only think, let me spend our lobbying dollars on lobbyists in DC who can take lawmakers and their staff out to dinner. How about our big technology companies find a way at cost to improve all of our computer systems in our government? That's patriotism.
There you go. Speaking of corporate America, I serve on the board of directors of three public companies. One of the things that we think about all the time, and that I know a lot of others in business think about, is the role ESG should play in corporate America. Specifically, more and more corporate CEOs find themselves having to take positions on issues that are seemingly political. They get accused of wokeness. I mean, look what happened to Chick-fil-A recently. I think of Chick-fil-A as a Southern conservative company, and they were branded as being too woke for hiring a DEI officer. So how deeply do you think public companies should delve into this? Or should we all just kind of stand back and be hands off?
This is so complicated and unfortunately, and shouldn't be such a minefield, because businesses are not woke or not woke, right? And when we get angry at CEOs for making money, we have to remember what their incentives are, right? A CEO's job is to make, you know, have their customers want to buy their product, have their employees want to stay and be productive. And if it's a public company, have their shareholders be rewarded. One, two, three. Right? It is not their job to do good or be politically active. However, doing good, if it makes your company better, if it makes you retain better employees, if it makes your customers happy, if it makes the city you operate in safer or better, it behooves businesses to take a stand. And we've seen them doing that. And the sad thing is, because things have now turned into identity politics, we're starting to see businesses retreat, right? It was just a few years ago with the bathroom bill, right? You saw the NBA say, you know what? We're out of this state. You saw companies like Salesforce say, Indiana, nope, we don't need to be here. But now things have become so politically charged, or now CEOs are expected to weigh in or take a stand on so many issues, you're starting to see them retreat. Look what just happened to Bud Light and Target, right? And both of those companies have been supporting LGBTQ initiatives for years and years. And now they are just in the hottest of hot water. And with the exception of Bob Iger at Disney, I can't think of another CEO that wants to get into a battle like this. And Bob didn't pick that battle. And so it's really complicated. And especially when you think about this small group who's now attacking businesses. They're tiny, but they're loud. And Jay, they're not going to stop with, we're going to boycott Target because they're selling Pride t-shirts. This same group is going to eventually keep going. They're going to sue every company that has any affinity group, any women's group, right? Which is crazy, because this whole notion that like DEI is taking over the world. Come on now. Like, there's also an affinity group at every corporation in America, and it's called the white dudes that run it. Like, it's crazy that we're trying to just create more environments to help people succeed. And that's not a reason to vilify anyone. Right before I did this, when I worked in banking, my husband and I both started our careers on the same day at Credit Suisse in the same training program. And he went to Princeton and he played lacrosse there. And so he has a huge community that all work on Wall Street and look like him and sound like him. So when we both started, there were 10 guys to wave him over and say, let me be your mentor and help you. And I don't begrudge that group. I just want to recreate it for people that look like me and look like you. And so it's crazy that efforts like that are now being demonized in this Make America Great idea, which is rooted in taking America to a place that served only a portion of the population. And it just doesn't make sense, because we just have a far more diverse population in 2023. And you sit on three corporate boards. If a company wants to hire the next generation of people, they need to know what those people also care about.
You host now the 11th hour, Stephanie Ruhle, 11 p.m. at night, Eastern Time, which is pretty late.
It is.
It's 8 p.m. in California, prime time. What is your goal for each show, and what constitutes a good show for you? What's a high five show?
So every single thing that we make, whether it's my show every night, and I'm the business analyst for NBC News when I help people finance on Today's Show, it's just one goal. How do we help people get better and smarter? And we look at every segment that we do after, and then we evaluate it. And, you know, I'm hypersensitive because we live in a time when things are hyper-politicized and people are saying that people are biased and, you know, oh, are we moving to the middle? Or are we talking both sides? Like, how about no sides? How about just cover the truth? And I think people assume that the media, in my opinion, is more liberal than it is, because during the Trump administration, it seemed that way. But during the Trump administration, you had a president and his surrogates who would actively lie about lots and lots of things and continue to. And so I think that my goal at 11 o'clock at night, I don't have breaking news. I don't have reporters I need to throw to. So we can sit down and say, here's the most important news of the day. We're going to tell you what happened. And then I'm going to bring some smart experts on, and they're going to tell us what it means. And when someone is an informed expert, right, what we're providing them with is informed perspective. And that doesn't mean it's an ideology, but because you, Jay Johnson, are an expert, you have an opinion. But like, I'd like to think that we have an educated audience who is totally open to changing their opinions, that has an open mind and is willing to change it. And if every person that I bring on our show is someone that I respect what they do, I respect their expertise, then I think we have a real chance of being, or I know we're successful at helping people get better and smarter. My goal now is, how do we really start to cover some of these cultural hot button issues that I think we avoid talking about?
Right.
And I think that in the beginning of these culture wars, I wanted to ignore them because I'm like, these are made up fights. I'm not going to get it. I'm not going to cover these stories. They're not even true. But the problem is they've taken hold. And so we do have to talk about these issues because I think in a number of them, the far right has hijacked them and there's lots of misinformation. And then the rest of the world doesn't talk about a lot of them because we fear saying something out of step. We fear getting canceled. We fear saying something offensive. And I want to change that in that I know at this point, or I believe I've built up my credibility and my trust with my audience that, listen, there are some thorny subjects out there. And instead of people having bad information, let's try to bring on some experts and get them some good information. Because when I leave work and I am at school, or I'm at a youth sports event, or I'm at dinner, people are talking about a lot of things that are in this cultural zeitgeist. And I think there's a lot of misinformation, right? Just the other day on TV, I brought up the president of Joe Biden's age. And a person who was on TV with me got angry and said, why are we even talking about this? Don't you think this is ageist? And you know what, Jay? Sure. Is it ageist? Maybe. But I know that people outside the newsroom are talking about it. So we can avoid talking about it. We can pretend that it doesn't exist, or we can at least acknowledge it. And so I think that sometimes the news where I exist gets too careful and wants to be super sensitive to everyone out there. But we're not super sensitive in our real lives, in our personal lives, and certainly not with how we vote. So I think we need to be not brutally mean, but I think we need to be brutally honest about what are real concerns people have, what are inflated concerns people have, and what are real policies happening out there.
I'd like to play an excerpt of an interview you did from January of 2023. It runs about a minute long. It's with Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert.
Oh, gosh.
In the midst of the vote to elect a Speaker of the House of Representatives. So let's take a moment to listen to that.
Then we have to make sure that there is a check and a balance and that there are rules in place. We need the tools that are available to us to actually govern the way that we campaign.
Okay, then here's where I'm scratching my head. If you're talking about a person that'll unite the Republican Party, I heard you this afternoon talk about consensus. Perhaps you and I have a different definition of consensus. He's got 200 votes. Yesterday, you backed Jim Jordan. Today, you're backing Byron Donalds as Speaker. He's got 20 votes. You think that guy's getting to 218 tomorrow?
I know that there are many of our colleagues who are cheering us on silently. And
silently won't
Kevin
help,
McCarthy.
Ma'am. 218 votes.
We're going to get there.
I'm
as
be
long
honest
as it takes,
you.
We are going to get there. And we're going to make sure that this is right for the American people. We want to see change in Washington, D.C., and we want to see policies that are passed that actually help the American people. Look, Kevin McCarthy has been in leadership for 14 years. What does he have to show for that? We aren't just electing somebody who can fundraise and just rubber stamp him into office. That's not what I was elected to do. What you're seeing here is a constitutional republic at work. It may look messy, it may look chaotic,
but this is us working and using
our votes. And I believe our founding fathers intended it to be this way.
Okay, well, our founding fathers aren't here, so let's get real and let's get practical. You can say what you believe. I believe children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. That's a song. You are backing a guy with 20 votes. Is he getting to 218 tomorrow? People who are silently cheering him on will not help when they round everybody up and ask for a vote tomorrow.
So first of all, I got to wonder what public affairs person thought it was a good idea for Lauren Boebert to go on national TV and be sliced to bits by Stephanie Ruhle. But in that exchange, you were not just asking questions and extracting a position. You took an opportunity to really confront her and seriously question the legitimacy of what she was saying. So explain that moment for us.
Thank you. In a normal circumstance, I would not have booked Lauren Boebert to come on my show. And I would not do a wide-ranging interview with Lauren Boebert because she has a long, long history of spreading conspiracy theories. And I do have regret that during in 2016, when Donald Trump was running, we would bring all sorts, me included, all sorts of Donald Trump surrogates on television, who, as soon as the cameras were rolling, were immediately spouting nonsense lies. And even the best journalists sitting on the other side of the table can't catch every single one if straight out of the gate they're saying that the sky is green and the grass is blue. And so I made a decision after that. We're only going to bring on people who are actually working on lawmaking, working on policies. And normally when you hear from a Lauren Boebert or Marjorie Taylor Greene, I mean, Marjorie for a long period of time wasn't even on any committees, but they were just seeking media attention. And so it never made sense. I didn't ever cover a lot of the crazy things they said. But in this case, Lauren Boebert was one of five people that were blocking our government working, right? Until you get a speaker confirmed, Congress is not functioning. Our government isn't functioning. So I
think you have no Congress. There's no
right time. It was an important time. And so in that interview, we didn't, you know, some people were angry, like, why didn't you confront her about guns? Or why don't you confront her about it? All those other things were ancillary. This is about what was she doing with the vote? And my frustration was sort of, it goes to, you know, the best Logan Roy quote from Succession about her being a serious person. And, you know, politics in some ways has turned into such a media circus. And listen, I'm grateful that she came on. And I don't think it was a knockout drag. It was a knockdown drag out fight. Right. We disagreed. But I'm glad that she came on. But I'll tell you, during the commercial break, right before she started, she said she had listened to the segment before. And I heard her. She said, wow. And you just sit here and you go on air. How do you get a gig like this? And what gave me a pit in my stomach is how much of this is a show, right? How much is this, right? And these people, and they're going to get themselves on TV and they're, am I going to get a punch in here and a swing in there? Like, I don't want to get in arguments on TV, especially not at 11 o'clock at night when the majority of my viewers are having a drink, sitting on the couch, sitting in bed, right? I want to have a respectful, relaxed discourse. And you can ask tough questions. The frustration is when we're just telling people things that aren't true, right? And we're going back to the forefathers. Well, if we're really going to have a conversation about our forefathers, I'm damn sure they wouldn't have been down with people having AR-15s in this country. But when I try to have as many practical conversations as possible, and when you get into that lane, you know, you're just in a silly place. And with, I think when I interviewed her, we were between vote 6 and 7, there was no time to be silly.
So let me ask you about a different interview you did recently. You went to the White House and interviewed the President of the United States. When I was in office as secretary, I used to have to go to the White House all the time for cabinet meetings, NSC meetings, principal committee meetings, ceremonies, events, meetings with the president. It's like, oh, another one. But he never got old, I must say. It never got old entering the West Wing. So what is that like for a journalist who has a one-on-one with the President of the United States?
It was a huge, huge privilege to get to sit down with the president, just to be there. About 5 weeks before, I'd gotten to go to the White House, and I met him with a number of other journalists soon after the State of the Union. I would say that getting the interview was, a privilege, and and also for my team, because, my show doesn't always cover the sexiest topics, right? We don't cover, a lot of the headlines that make lots of noise and news and the infighting. We don't, like, we really, really do try to focus on covering policy. And I know that's not always sexy and fun, and it doesn't make segments that go viral or make you the hottest thing. And I think that I'm trying to just be a grinder, and I know my team is too. So for the White House to even invite us to participate and me get to meet the president and talk about policy and what had been passed in the first two years of the administration, I was honored to get to do. And to interview the president was a great honor. I would say that the person who helped me about 15 minutes before, my colleague and friend, Savannah Guthrie, gave me great advice. You know, she's interviewed a number of presidents, and she said, the president, no matter who it is, isn't your enemy. Time is your enemy. And when you're sitting across from the president, and you can ask anything, right? There's no rules. You can ask anything. But when you've got 10 minutes, and the minute you open your mouth, the clock is running, and you've got about 30 subjects you want to hit. It was Savannah who said to me 15 minutes before, girl, you got about three questions. You got about three things you're going to get. Focus on those three things, because time's going to fly. And so it was a great privilege to get to interview him. And I would say one of my takeaways that I don't think I've talked about, and I think the president should, Joe Biden has, when you're sitting across from him, 5 feet away from him, a notable stutter that he's managing when he speaks. And there's lots of narratives out there about him losing a step, him losing his train of thought, you know. And when you're sitting 5 feet away from him, and I'm not opining on his age, but when you're sitting 5 feet away from someone and you can see them, right, tackle any question you throw at them, but you can see them stop mid-sentence, take a breath, and then come in that sentence from another direction, you are just taken by what a feat that is. And I know it's had an impact when people hear about it, when they read about it and they realize it, but then we forget it again. And when you're sitting across from him tackling every question and you're also watching him manage that, that was a takeaway that hit me, that I think there's a compassion that we're missing as a culture. And I get it. Politics is brutal, but I wish people could win and lose in politics based on policy and facts.
Right. That's a good point. And it's an interesting observation of him in person 5 feet away. Stephanie,
I wish this is not complimentary. I wish the White House would let Joe be Joe in the way that Trump's team lets Trump be Trump. Because what our country is missing is humanity, and it is compassion. And those are two things that Joe Biden has in spades. And I think that the more people could see that, it's what we all need in every town and every city. And there's lots of other things that you could complain about, but I'm just saying, I think that's a tremendous asset that he has that I think people don't get to experience.
Good point. Interesting observation.
You know him. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree. You recall when he said there should be regime change in Russia, and his staff, oh, no, he didn't really mean to say that. He didn't really say that. And I was on Meet the Press the next Sunday. And I said, you know what? He was absolutely right. And he's always the most experienced public servant in the room. So maybe he deserves to be right.
Yeah.
So, this is an R&B show, classic R&B. Do you have any favorite R&B artist or selection?
Well, I will tell you, I was thrilled. My father just sent it to me recently. So when I was a little girl, my father always sang Aretha Franklin's Respect to me. I love her. I love the song. You know what? He sent it to me last week after Tina Turner died, because I had written a tweet that said, for everybody who loves Beyonce, who said that Beyonce broke the mold, Tina built it. And my father read it and he called me on the phone and he said, how could you disrespect Aretha like this? And then he sent me an article that Rolling Stone did the 500 greatest songs of all time. And their number one is Aretha, Respect.
What you want, baby, I got it. What you need, do you know I got it too. All I'm asking you is for a little respect when you come
just
home.
A little bit.
Hey, baby, just a little bit. When you get home.
I remember once I went to an embassy party in Washington, 2015. And, you know, everybody in the room is looking to see who everybody else in the room is and the seating chart, who you're seated next to. So I asked the maitre d', could you please tell me who I'm seated next to? And he said, well, sir, we have seated you in between Mr. Hank Aaron and Ms. Aretha Franklin. We hope you don't mind.
And you said, you can just bury me here.
Exactly. Right. I was like a teenager who wanted an autograph. It was amazing. Thank you, Stephanie Ruhle, and thank you for giving me more than 10 minutes.
I really, really appreciate you having me on. I'm honored.